I'm Gail Harris in for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Most little girls stop playing dress-up around age 5 or so. Ruth Reichold rediscovered it well into adulthood for a very good reason. As the new food critic for the New York Times, where a good review could create a star and a bad review could close down the place, Reichold wanted to be sure that her restaurant experience would be the same as, say, what a little old lady in sensible shoes and a bad haircut might encounter. Her new book, Garlic and Sapphires, is a poignant and frequently hilarious account of what it meant to assume 6 other personas, and also how she managed to stay afloat in the often treacherous waters of the Times style department. So here's our question for you this hour. What do you expect and believe you deserve when you eat out? Whom do you turn to for guidance about where to go and what to eat? What makes you trust the critic or not? Should a food critic only be concerned with what's on the plate or the entire experience? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And Ruth Reichold joins me now from the studios of KUOW in Seattle. Welcome, Ruth.
Good morning.
So what a surprise, first of all, to open the book and find out that you actually didn't want this job at first. You know, I can imagine hands smacking against foreheads all across the country of, what? You know, you're a native New Yorker. How could you not want to be the food critic of the New York Times?
I was at the LA Times. I loved my job there. And I was scared. I was at the LA Times, which was then known as the Velvet Coffin. It was a very cozy place to work. And the New York Times was widely known as a place of sharp elbows, a place where you really had to watch your back. And I thought, you know, what do I want that for? I was also, you know, I wasn't sure I was ready to take on the most important voice in American restaurants. So I kept hesitating. I tried very hard to make them not hire me.
Which was pretty funny. I mean, you were the job interviewee from the Black Lagoon. I mean, you were not eager to please, let's say.
No, I kept saying, you know, why would you want to hire me? And I did everything I could to persuade them not to hire me. Little did I know that the less you want a job, I mean, with really powerful jobs, when everybody wants them, the less you want it, the more desirable you become to the people who are hiring you. So while everybody else was lobbying for the job, I was trying to be as rude and nasty as possible. And it backfired on me.
And job seekers, perhaps we should all take note of that. But when you finally did take the job, whom did you imagine yourself writing for?
Well, one of the things in my obnoxiousness when I went in to talk to the editors of the New York Times, I said, why would you want me? The New York Times has always spoken from a very Olympian viewpoint. Your critics speak as if they're right, and I've never believed that I was right. I mean, we're talking about things that are taking place in my mouth. It's one person's opinion, and my reviews have always been from this very personal place. And on top of that, your reviews are essentially consumer reports for the people who are going to go out to eat. And my reviews have always been written for all the people who will never get to go to the restaurant. I mean, my feeling is that there are probably 1,000 people who go to these very expensive places. And I don't want to write for those 1,000 people and say, when you get there, you know, order the steak instead of the chicken or don't have the lobster because it's too salty. My idea is to take those thousands and thousands of people who can't go there and try and have them experience the restaurant. You know, really write the review so that they can taste the food, so that they're there.
Well, one of your first reviews of the legendary Le Cirque was particularly difficult for you. I think it's fair to say you sweated bullets over that one. Wonder if you'd read an excerpt from that review, and then let's talk a little bit about that experience.
Oh, I don't have a book with me.
Don't have a book. Oh, dear.
No.
Okay. Then let's describe it for everybody, because it really, you went in first time as Molly. Who was Molly?
Well, When I got to New York, I found out that every restaurant in New York had a huge picture of me hanging in the kitchen with "wanted" over it and a reward. You know, spot this woman, earn $500. And so I decided that I couldn't go in looking like myself, that I had to put on a disguise. So my first disguise was a woman named Molly Hollis, who was a school teacher, retired school teacher from the Midwest, whose husband had made a lot of money in real estate. And she and her husband came to New York every few months to shop, go to the theater, and eat in good restaurants.
And this is someone you just kind of made up. You imagined her.
This is someone that I just imagined. I had gone to an acting coach to help me make my disguise, and she said, you can't just put on a wig and some makeup. You have to really be this person. So we invented Molly, and I got a used Armani suit, and I put on a lot of layers so I looked much heavier than I really am. And I got this short ash brown wig, and this makeup woman made me, she changed the shape of my mouth, and she got rid of most of my eyebrows and put wrinkles on my face, and I had very proper little jewelry. I'm not in real life a very proper little person. And I went with one of my mother's best friends. The two of us went into Le Cirque, and we were treated horribly. We were, you know, made to wait for 45 minutes for our table. We were seated in smoking, although we kept asking to be in non-smoking. The wine list that I got was snatched out of my hands and given to a man three tables away. And I found that as Molly, I was unable to defend myself. So when I wanted the wine list back, instead of just saying, you know, I would like a wine list now, I just kept saying, excuse me, might I have a wine list? So I then went back as myself. I went as Molly many times and never got treated very well. And Molly said, you know, this isn't right. I'm spending a lot of money in this restaurant, and I want to be treated beautifully. I want the dream of glamour. And instead, I'm being humiliated. And it's just not right. And I went as my final visit. I did not make the reservation in my own name, but I went without a disguise. And I went 45 minutes early for a reservation, and there were all these people milling around waiting for their tables, muttering angrily because their tables aren't ready. And the owner spots me, and he comes forward and leads me through the throng and says, the King of Spain is waiting in the bar, but your table is ready. And I turned to my nephew, who I had brought with me, and I said, oh, yeah, the King of Spain is waiting in the bar. And he turned around and looked in the bar and said, that is the King of Spain. I saw him on TV last night.
Well, if you don't mind my quoting from your review, you make the point in it, but nobody goes to Le Cirque just to eat. People go for the experience of being in a great restaurant. Sometimes they get it, sometimes they don't. It all depends on who they are. And that clearly was reflected in your experience.
Yes, and I decided that I was new to the New York Times. It was, I think, my seventh review. And I decided that what I would do was write a review that the first half would be Molly writing the review of her experience, and the second half would be the restaurant critic of the New York Times, and that just to show how different the experience could be.
Was it just the experience, or was the food also different?
The food was a little different. I mean, there was one moment where I noticed that even the berries that I got as the restaurant critic were larger than the berries that Molly had gotten. And I, you know, had this fantasy that there was somebody out in the kitchen whose job it was to sort berries and make sure that the bigger ones went to the important people. But Molly didn't get bad food. I mean, the truth is that there is a limited amount that a restaurant can do. I mean, what they did, they showered truffles upon me when I was the restaurant critic, and, you know, they gave me the best of everything. But, you know, the reality is that for the most part, the food doesn't change that much. But what does change is the experience changes enormously.
Well, and it certainly couldn't have felt very good to waltz up to the maitre d' and be dressed as Molly and instantly be dismissed as somewhat of no consequence.
No, it's humiliating. It's, you know, here you go to the restaurant, and my feeling is that restaurants are a kind of theater, and we all go to them for many reasons, and food is one of those reasons, but a big part of it is you go to feel glamorous, taken care of. I think it's no accident that the restaurants as an institution were invented right after the French Revolution, when all of the cooks and maitre d's and butlers were thrown out into the streets, and they no longer had the aristocracy to work for, so they created restaurants for common people.
Well, we're going to continue
a democratic institution.
We're going to continue talking about the restaurant experience with Ruth Reichel this hour. Here's our question. Whose side do you think the food critic should be on? Yours or the restaurant's? 1-800-423-8255 to join the conversation. I'm Gail Harris in for Dick Gordon, and this is The Connection. I'm Gail Harris, in for Dick Gordon, and this is The Connection. Ruth Reichel is my guest this hour. We're talking about her new memoir, Garlic and Sapphires. And you can check out a few pictures of Ruth as herself and in disguise on our website, theconnection.org. In fact, I'm looking at one right now, Ruth, of you as your mother, Miriam. It's really quite wonderful. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. We'd like to hear from you. How do you like your food critics to dish it out? Ruth, I'm sorry I had to interrupt you as we were taking a break a moment ago. You were talking about the connection between food and politics, and for you that started very early on in Berkeley.
Yeah, that's how I became really passionate about food. Was, you know, the war in Vietnam ended, and those of us who had been active in the fight against the war and in civil rights started looking for another place to put our energies, and the whole issue of food was sitting there. And, you know, actually, it is today more than ever, I think, a major issue in American politics, and something that we need to think about. But I had not thought that I would become a restaurant critic. I opened a group of us opened a collective restaurant, and I sort of fell into writing about restaurants and found it enormous fun.
I want to ask about some of these other personas that you assumed, where they came from, and the kind of freedom and insight, really, that they gave you into yourself as you made your way from restaurant to restaurant.
Well, my probably most favorite, most useful of my disguises was Betty, who was a woman I found on the bus. I was taking the bus home from work one day, and a woman got on looking very tired. You know, one of those older women who, you know, you see all over New York. And I stood up to give her my seat, and she said, "Are you really giving me your seat?" And I said yes, and she said, "Oh, dearie, thank you so much. No one ever stands up for me. I feel invisible." And I thought, invisible, I mean, that's what I've been trying to be. Mm-hmm. And I watched her in the world and saw she really was invisible. And it was very easy to turn myself into her. I got, you know, shapeless dress and some of those sort of lace-up high-heeled Oxfords and a frumpy gray wig and a big pair of glasses and one of those huge pocketbooks. And I turned myself into Betty Jones. who was, for years, Betty flew under the radar in New York restaurants, because in a group of people, when friends were told to call me Aunt Betty, she really disappeared. No one ever noticed her. And it being Betty, on not just in restaurants, but on the street, on the subway, was it was a very powerful experience. On the other hand, I turned myself into Chloe, the blonde bombshell.
became Marilyn Monroe.
I became a version of Marilyn Monroe. And that was amazing. You know, I always wonder, do blondes have more fun? And I channeled my inner blonde and discovered that, yes, the world was a very different place for Chloe. That, you know, Chloe had long red fingernails and this amazing golden hair and false eyelashes and lots of makeup and a beautiful cocktail suit and very nice jewelry. And, you know, her world was one where, you know, taxis came screeching to a halt to, you know, vie for her business. And, you know, men picked her up in bars and, you know, wanted to take her to dinner. And every restaurant seated her right in the front. I mean, Betty would walk into a restaurant and be taken instantly to the back table where the maitre d' hoped no one would see her. Whereas Chloe, right up front, you know, we want everyone to know that this is the kind of patron we have.
And did the food taste better as Chloe than it did as quiet little invisible Betty?
Well, I have to say that in the end, the food was always going into my mouth, and the food tasted the same whether I was Betty or Chloe. Although I must say that when I turned myself into Miriam, my mother, there was a real moment when walking into these very. I took Miriam to the Four Seasons in New York, and there was a kind of magic in feeling how much my mother would have loved to have been able to afford that restaurant. It was a place she always dreamed of going. And I think that being Miriam there so changed the experience for me, because after all, at that point, I had been a restaurant critic for 20 years, and there was a certain, I'd been jaded. And being my mother, I experienced it in this wonderful way where everything did taste better to her.
Well, and one of the things she personified was the very, I don't want to say complaining customer, but she was difficult to please, let's say. And we've got a listener who wants to chime in on that point from Brookline, Massachusetts. Polly's on the line. Hi, Polly.
Hi. Hello, Ruth.
Hi.
My second career is being a pastry chef. And for years when I've gone out to dinner with family and friends, I've always made it a point if I found service is lacking or if there is something wrong with an entree that I receive, I will always send it back, tell the maitre d' what is wrong, tell the wait staff, you know, what is wrong, because I feel that restaurants should know when customers are dissatisfied. Also, by the same token, when I've had a wonderful meal, I also let the staff know how good it is. Because there have been times if someone finds out that I'm a pastry chef, you do get comp from the kitchen, shall we say. So I was wondering, how do you handle when you've ordered a dish done rare, for example, and it comes to you overdone, or you've ordered a dish medium and it comes to you, you know, blood rare? What do you do?
Okay, let me answer this in two ways. One is, as a restaurant critic, I never sent anything back, because you are doing everything you can to avoid being taken notice of. So you when people say, how's the food, no matter what you say, it's fine.
Mm-hmm.
Unless I happen to be my mother. As I'm no longer.
Who used to make you cringe when she would do this.
Yes, and my mother sent everything back. And when I was Miriam, if the soup wasn't hot enough, it went back. If there was too much dressing on the salad, it went back.
Uh-huh.
But let me say, as a civilian, which I now am, I believe really fervently that As diners, we have a responsibility, and we get the restaurants we deserve. And
I agree.
Having a meal is a kind of collaboration. Mm-hmm. You are paying for this, and you should have things the way you want them. So you shouldn't be ridiculous about it and send everything back. But if things are not the way you have ordered them, I think it behooves you to ask for it done as you want it. I really think that part of getting a good meal is being a good diner.
Polly, thanks so much for the call. And also, I want to ask the other piece about this, Ruth, which is writing about it, because it has to be so difficult to describe how something tastes. You certainly do it very well, but it's so subjective. I mean, what tastes like pear to me might taste like pineapple to you. So how do you come up with those descriptions that ideally, I guess, leave us all drooling?
Well, I always try very hard to write about food in ways that don't use the words delicious, tasty. I mean, it's a very limited vocabulary we have for flavor. And I've always sort of tried to evoke a mood that leads you to experience the flavor in ways that, put you in a place. The oddest thing about this is none of us have any idea if what I taste is the same as what anybody else tastes. And so you try and describe it in a way that, if you close your eyes, you can imagine yourself there. It's an exercise in imagination, just trying to get you there.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255 if you'd like to join us in talking about food. Ruth, I also want to ask about, at the Times, you encountered some resistance when you wanted to expand the horizons a bit. You wanted to cover more than just the quote-unquote important restaurants. Why did you think it was necessary to fight that fight and to get out to some of the ethnic restaurants that were coming onto the scene?
Well, for a lot of reasons. One, I had come from California. I truly loved Asian food, Korean food, Japanese food, Thai food. I loved Hispanic food, Mexican food, the food Central America. And it hurt me that these were always relegated to the cheap eats column. And it seemed to me that we really ought to be giving these cuisines real respect. And the New York Times had been focusing, they'd been looking towards Europe and focusing very much on those cuisines. I also believe that, one way of understanding a culture is through their food. And, it's very hard to dislike a culture if you love their food. And it's a really important way of learning about people. When I was at the Los Angeles Times, I was the food editor, not just the restaurant critic, and we used to do a lot of pieces about, neighborhood, walking through neighborhood grocery stores. And, what we found was that we were introducing whole populations to our readers, and that they really appreciated it. And I think you do the same thing with restaurants.
Yeah, interesting window. Good point. North Augusta, South Carolina is where Walter is calling us from. Hi, Walter. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Great show. A lot of fun. I have to say, my wife and I, probably the number one thing that we spend our expendable income on is dining out, because that's something that not only we can do together, not like seeing a movie, but we can actually have a conversation while it's going on. And I have to say that I'm also in the restaurant business. I originally got in the conversation because the question came up, should the critic be in favor of the restaurant or the patron? And I think neither. I think that they should take a neutral attitude. And something that she mentioned earlier I thought hit right on is, once I read a review, I want to be able to close my eyes and envision being there, whether it's a fine dining restaurant or a casual restaurant. But the purpose of my call was to say that I think that a critic should go in and consider what the restaurant's trying to accomplish, not have one set of standards that everybody's judged on. Because if you do, then you can't do a fair analysis of the smaller restaurant that you were talking about.
I'm not sure what you mean about the one set of standards, Walter. Can you...
Like I said, I'm in the restaurant business and right across the river in Augusta, Georgia, but the they'll come in and they'll say, okay, a critic will come in and say, all right, they have a set of standards of, you know, whether or not a restaurant takes reservations. If they don't, this kind of a mark against you if you don't, because they think that all restaurants should have reservations. All restaurants should have certain things on their menus, and not all restaurants are trying to accomplish the same goals.
Got it. Thanks. Thanks, Walter.
I
appreciate your
comment. I couldn't agree more with that. I mean, you know, I think what you really have to do is you judge a restaurant on its own standards. Are they meeting their standards? Are they accomplishing what they want to do? If you use that criteria, you can judge a hot dog stand and a, you know, very exclusive French restaurant, and they can be equally good. And the experience can be equally good, but that's the only way you can really manage to judge a wide range of restaurants.
Well, and that's also where you got the idea of dressing up, right? To help keep restaurants on their toes for all of their customers, to do their best possible job for everyone who walked through the door.
Absolutely. I think one of the other things that a really good critic can do is make the experience better. I mean, not just a restaurant critic, but a film critic or a music critic. You make the experience better for people who then go to, you know, be at the restaurant or the movie. But you give them something, some way to experience this in a richer and fuller way.
To Sanford, North Carolina now, we want to hear from Raymond, who's calling in. Hello, Raymond, and welcome.
Good morning. I'm calling because I need to ask a question, and then there was another part to it, but the young lady said you had already spoken about it, but I didn't hear your answer. The first part was, I was always told as a person who goes to a restaurant, if there's something about your food you do not like, you don't send it back because the kitchen staff can do anything they want to it and then send it back to you. Now, I don't know whether that's an old wives' tale or not, but I've always had that in the back of my mind when I wanted to send something back.
I think a lot of us think about that, Raymond. What about it, Ruth? Are we just being paranoid?
I think you're just being paranoid. I mean, if you're really worried about that, they can do it before you send it back. I mean, I think that, you know, the act of going to a restaurant is, it's a trusting act. I mean, you're putting yourself in the hands of the kitchen, and you have to believe that they're going to do right by you.
Raymond, thanks for the call. That is a question I think a lot of us have. And maybe it's reassuring to know that restaurants do not view this as an insult if you say, well, wait a minute, this is really not the way I asked for it.
I think most don't view it as an insult. I mean, of course, you do occasionally encounter the chef who considers himself a great artist and says, you know, I only serve my chicken rare, and if you don't like it that way, too bad. My feeling is, wait a minute, I'm paying for it.
Well, and there's also the great scene you describe, and I forget now which restaurant it was, but when you were out as your mother and sending everything back, they were trying harder. You got their attention. They were really working hard to please you.
Yes. I mean, it was for me who, in real life, I am not a squeaky wheel. And it was amazing to become my mother, become this extremely, excruciatingly demanding person, and watch the waiter very grudgingly give her respect.
It is a great scene. We're dining out with Ruth Reichel this hour, talking about the sometimes not-so-savory New York restaurant scene. So here's our question to you. What do you expect and believe you deserve when you eat out? And how often do you get what you think you deserve? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Gail Harrison for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Gail Harris in for Dick Gordon, and we are talking about food on The Connection this hour, some pretty glorious food, actually. Whom do you turn to for guidance about where to go and what to eat? Do you trust your stomach, or do you sample the reviews first? Our number is 1-800-423-TALK, and Ruth Reichel is with us, whose new memoir is Garlic and Sapphires. I want to go to Newbury, Massachusetts now. John's on the line. Hi, John.
Hi there. Ms. Reichel, it's a pleasure to listen to you, as it is a pleasure to read your books.
Thank you.
I have a couple questions. Just because I've had a little experience in the restaurant area, a lot of our experience as customers at restaurants is shaped by servers, you know, waiters, waitresses, but they're not always responsible for what our experience is, and although we don't really know it necessarily as consumers, I mean, the kitchen or the manager can cause them some pain by overloading them or delaying their orders and so forth. And yet we sort of predicate all our response to the restaurant on that. I assume you had ways of dealing with that in your reviews, you know, hitting different waitresses or waiters different times of day. That's the first question. The second one is apart from your disguises to test restaurants' hospitality, did you have other tests that you would play? I mean, like, for instance, in a really fancy restaurant, dropping a fork and seeing how long it took somebody to pick it up and hopefully tipping them well afterwards.
To the second question, yes, there were lots of little things that I would do, you know, adding an extra person to the table at the last minute and seeing how they dealt with that, or, you know, showing up early and seeing how they dealt with it, having someone show up late. In fact, as a critic, one of the things I did often was get everybody else to show up late myself so they couldn't change the table if they recognized me. You know, they were already there with maybe not the best waiter. You know, let me say that I was a waitress for many years. I worked my way through college as a waitress. And I used to envision the waiter as the mediator in a war that the customers didn't even know was taking place. But I always saw restaurants as sort of a war between the kitchen and the customers, and that your fairly thankless task as a server was to be the mediator between these two warring groups, and that if you did it really well, the table would never know that the kitchen was at war with them. And, you know, you would go back and say, you know, so the people on table 8 are eating too slowly, so don't fire that yet. And, the chef would say, you know, I don't care, the food's coming out now anyway. And you'd have to deal with that. And, you know, I think the fact that I had waited table for such a long time really informed my reviews, and I was, I think, more aware than most people of when the fault was the kitchen's and when it was the server's.
Certainly would up the empathy quotient. John, thanks so much for the call. To Jeremy now, who's on the line from Boston, Massachusetts. Hi, Jeremy.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call. I love what you just said about the war between the kitchen and the table. That's great. I actually worked in food service for a long time. I worked my way through college as a waiter. I also worked as a caterer. I ended up in the kitchen for a while. And so I've seen a lot of different aspects of food service and restaurants. And in my family, we've always gone out to eat a lot. And we've gone to some very nice restaurants in New York. I live in Boston. I've eaten a lot of good restaurants in Boston. And my sister lives in Paris. I've eaten a lot of good restaurants in Paris and around the world. And it's always... Honestly, it's been my dream to be a food reviewer. I love it. It's something I love to do. Whenever I go out to a place that my friends can't necessarily get to, I'll write a review for them. And I've thought about doing that, and I feel like I'm in a good position, having been both a customer of a lot of good restaurants and also having worked in restaurants. I have a good perspective. I've often thought about just starting up my own website, like a blog, something like that, to review restaurants. And I wonder if you have an opinion about that. The way the internet has become, it's such a great medium for that type of, for restaurant reviewing, among other types of reviews. I was wondering if you have an opinion about that.
I think it's absolutely fabulous what's happening on the internet now. And when I go to a city that I don't know very well, the first thing I do is, you know, go to these blogs, and you get, you know, amazing feedback. And, you know, you find ones that you really like, people that you trust. And I think it's really changed the role of the restaurant critic. I mean, it used to be when Craig Claiborne, who virtually invented restaurant criticism as we know it in America, when he was a critic, his voice was extremely powerful. I think the internet has really taken the power away from the critics at papers, because you've got so many people weighing in, not just on the restaurants, but also weighing in on the critics. And it's a very interesting time. I mean, to me, it's fascinating that we as Americans have become such good diners. I mean, we are so much more comfortable in restaurants than we were 30 years ago, and so much more knowledgeable and so much more demanding. And it's why our restaurants are so much better than they used to be.
We have another Ruth who's joining us. This one is in Pawtucket, Rhode Island. Hi, Ruth.
Hi. I'm so pleased to speak with you this morning, Ms. Reichel. I'm a true fan and enjoyed your book, Tender at the Bone, as well, and look forward to reading this one. My husband and I went on our honeymoon 2 years ago to New Orleans, and we really found through the experience of choosing, you know, reading the restaurant reviews and the Times-Picayune before we went, a great experience for being a prelude to actually going to the restaurants, and that, in fact, it enhanced our experience of the restaurants that we chose. And so we've really found that reading, food writing in general, but good reviewers of restaurants and sort of describers and arbitrators of the experience to enhance our experience as we go to these places.
Ruth, thank you. I would imagine that feels like a good feedback, Ruth Reichel.
As it happens, Brett, who is the critic at the Times-Picayune, is among the best in the country. He's really good, and is precisely that kind of critic who will enhance your experience and, you know, give you very good advice and tell you, you know, what you should be looking for in the restaurant, not just, you know, what to order.
At one point, Ruth Reichel, you wrote a review called Why I Disapprove of What I Do. And you kind of make two major points there. I wonder if you'd make the disapproving part and then perhaps read an excerpt in which you argue with yourself about that.
It was a piece that came very much out of being Betty. And her experience of, you know, being treated badly in restaurants. And then at one point, she came out of a restaurant and found this homeless person, you know, with a sign saying hungry. And it just turned me around. And I argued about with myself, it's what is the morality of, you know, eating meals that cost hundreds of dollars? And I go through all the arguments, and then at the end, I ended up saying, yes, there are still restaurants where rich people get to remind themselves that they are different from you and me, but there are fewer and fewer of them. American restaurants have changed. Going out to eat used to be like going to the opera. Today, it is more like going to the movies. And so everyone has become a critic. I couldn't be happier. The more people pay attention to what and how they eat, the more attuned they become to their own senses and the world around them. And I had started this piece by saying that when I first became a restaurant critic, MFK Fisher said to me, "You can't be a restaurant critic unless you are one of those ambitious sorts willing to walk on your grandmother's grave." And I ended this piece by saying, when I remember that conversation with MFK Fisher, I wish I had not been quite so meek. When I rerun the loop in my mind, I turn to her and say this: no, you're wrong. A.J. Liebling had it right. All it really takes to be a restaurant critic is a good appetite.
Hmm. Well, that's certainly reassuring. You also include a number of recipes in the book. They're pretty simple. I enjoyed reading them and thinking, well, maybe I could do that. Things like roast chicken and spaghetti carbonara, kind of comfort food that you might make for yourself at home or for your family. And I wonder, with all the eating out you were doing and all the fancy foods you were consuming, was it important for you to cook for yourself as often as possible and to try and keep it simple?
Well, you know, one of the points of having these recipes in the book is that I really believe that cooking for our families is among the most important things that we can do. And I think that we've taken a terrible turn when everybody thinks that they ought to be cooking chef food at home. Chef food is wonderful. It's wonderful in restaurants. When I'm at home, what I want is very straightforward food, a roast chicken, scalloped potatoes. And so I tried to put the food that I really do cook at home. And it's, you know, everybody thinks, oh, I'm the editor of Gourmet Magazine. I must be a fabulous cook. In fact, I'm a good home cook. And I think that the more time we spend in restaurants, the more important it is for us to, you know, go home and eat straightforward food. And, you know, in the end, one of the reasons I stopped being a restaurant critic was that my son was getting older and he was saying, I wish we had dinner together. And leaving him every night was getting harder and harder for me. And I really wanted to have family meals. And I now go home every night and cook dinner after work. And I think that it is the glue that holds our family together.
And do you try in the pages of the magazine to keep those recipes accessible for people as opposed to looking and thinking, oh, there are 87 ingredients here. I couldn't possibly do that.
We are very conscious at Gourmet of that there are two ways of cooking now in America. One is recreational, and we do these very elaborate meals for people who, like me, love to cook all weekend. But that's one kind of cooking. The other kind of cooking is the kind of cooking that most of us do on weeknights when, you know, you get home from work and you've got 20 minutes to make dinner. And we try and have 30 or 40 recipes every month that you can do very quickly. With just a few ingredients. And, you know, that's where I cook my family meals, you know, out of our gourmet everyday meals.
To Whitefish, Montana now, we want to hear from Adrian. Hello, Adrian.
Hi there.
Hi.
excuse me. I spent about 20 years in the food business, and I went to culinary school back in the late 80s and sort of cut my teeth in the Boston area and Seattle area at that time, which I remember as a very exciting time in food. And I did a little bit of a stint doing some food writing for a Montana-based magazine now that I'm here. But I've found over the years that, you know, when I go to higher-end restaurants that are much touted, I find them more often than not to be disappointing. And I get much more excited when I get to the city now about just getting myself some ethnic food. I just I get disappointed, and I don't feel like I'm incredibly picky or I'm impossible to please, but I know how to make good food. I've had really great food out. You know what I mean? And I'm wondering if that's ever happened for you.
Well, one of the chapters in the book, I think it happens for all of us. I mean, there's no question that, you know, you get prepared for a great meal and you go out and it's okay. You know, it's not terrible, but you think, I wish I'd gone to the little Thai restaurant down the street. It would have been more exciting. On the other hand, you know, one of the chapters in the book is I am finding myself in exactly that mood. I mean, I'm going to restaurant after restaurant that is just okay, and I'm getting very depressed. And then I go for a truly great meal, and it reminds me all over again of the magic of a truly talented chef and what it feels like to be in the hands of someone who is cooking food that you can't even imagine how this food came together and how exhilarating it is. And I think it's, you know, one of the things that keeps all of us going to these restaurants, because occasionally you find yourself faced with greatness, and it is extraordinary.
Adrian, thanks for the call. So after a review came out, Ruth, did you ever go back into a chef's kitchen and say, okay, I need to know, how did you do that?
No, I mean, one of the things that I was very fortunate, when I got to New York, I did not know any chefs in New York, and I wanted to keep it that way. So I never called the restaurants. I never went into their kitchens. I really kept my distance from the chefs. On the other hand, I did read everything I could about, you know, I leapt onto every piece of literature I could find about the chefs who I thought were really wonderful, trying to find out how did they do it.
Hmm. And a practical question I simply have to ask this one. How did you manage to stay thin with all of these phenomenal meals night after night at all of these incredible restaurants?
Well, you know, someday I am going to write the restaurant critic diet book. you know, I think the real truth is that when you're eating 12 or 14 meals a week in restaurants, you know that you're never more than a few hours from a really good meal. And you lose the obsession about food. You lose that need to eat everything on your plate, to say, oh, I just, you know, one more bite of this chocolate cake. And you learn to recognize your own hunger and to stop when you've had enough.
Well, we've been savoring this hour with you, Ruth Reichel. Thanks so much for being with us.
This has been a real pleasure. Thank you.
Ruth Reichel is the author of Garlic and Sapphires, The Secret Life of a Critic in Disguise. She joined us from a studio in Seattle, Washington. The Connection is produced by Jennifer Ehrlich, Catherine Fenollosa, Jen Mattson, Virginia Prescott, Christina Russo, and Doug Shugarts. Our senior producer is Tara Murphy. I'm Gail Harris. This is The Connection.